Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. As the sun rises over the quiet city of Kingston, New York on July 12, 1988, a local transient discovers the remains of 19-year-old Anna Cathcart. She was strangled and beaten to death with the letters KKK carved into her thighs. While her heartbroken family mourns and the police work around the clock to uncover the truth, the investigation is complicated by the entrance of the Reverend Al Sharpton, who insists that a racist killer is responsible. As investigators struggle to find evidence, Sharpton and his supporters denounce the entire area as a Klan den and make public pronouncements that a racist cult is operating throughout the area. Then, as if things can't get any worse, the transient who found the body confesses to an unspeakable sexual act against the corpse. Almost immediately after the media reports his alleged depravity, he changes his story and accuses the police of making him a patsy and a scapegoat. To add to the expanding circus, he tells the world he is really an undercover agent for the CIA, FBI, and Interpol. Only solving the crime can quell the chaos that threatens to ignite a powder keg of racial tension and get past the rumors to catch the real killer. But can investigators overcome the outside forces that repeatedly sidetrack their efforts? Find out in this new great true crime book from Richard T. Cahill, the author of Hopton's Ladder. The book we're featuring this evening is Sidetracked, The Betrayal and Murder of Anna Cathcart, with my special guest, journalist and author and attorney, Richard T. Cahill. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Richard T. Cahill, Jr.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much. Very, very involved case, very unusual, the incredible detail that you bring at the trial, and we'll talk about that very, very soon. First off, what is your, give our audience your personal background and your personal connection to this case, and finally, how did you come to be in a position to write Sidetracked?
Well, as by way of background, I've been an attorney for a little over 20 years. I was a prosecutor at one time. Shortly thereafter, I was a criminal defense attorney. And for a number of years since then, I've been practicing civil law. As far as how I got to write Sidetracked, I had written my first book, which was about the Lindbergh kidnapping. And it was about a year after it was released, and I had some people asking me, are you going to write another book? And I thought, you know, why not? It might be fun. And I started looking around, and then I suddenly realized there was a case right here at home where I live that had a lot of things that would really be interesting. It was kind of personal to me because the victim, Annie Cathcart, was a year ahead of me in high school. I knew her, and like many people in Kingston, was stunned when she was found dead that July morning. I didn't know her that well. She was very popular. Big surprise, I was a geek. So, you know, and I don't know if it's still this way in school, but in those days, popular kids didn't usually want to be seen with not so popular kids, unless they were, you know, making fun of them or whatever. But Annie wasn't like that. She didn't care about that. She was friendly to everybody. And little things like that get remembered, especially when, like me, you're a not so cool kid. And, you know, there were a lot of questions that I had that I wanted answered. And The case had so many interesting twists and turns, and as I started researching it and realized that I could not only write an interesting book about it, but I could present Annie in the positive light that I always felt she should have been presented, yet wasn't, that's when I made the decision that this would be my second book.
Now, before we talk about July 1988, New York, Kingston, you talk about a case that affects this case dramatically and is another case that has similarities, at least when people look at it initially, and that's the Tawana Browley case. So tell us about what happened approximately a year before Annie Cathcart was murdered, before we talk about what happened with her, what happened a year before, and what was Reverend Sharpton's involvement.
All right. In the latter part of November of the previous year, 1987, Tawana Browley, a 16-year-old African-American girl from just outside of Poughkeepsie, New York, a place actually called Wappingers Falls, New York, was reported missing. She was found on the lawn of a property or apartment complex where she had used to live in a garbage bag, although there were two witnesses who said they saw her climb into the bag herself. Nevertheless, she was found in the bag. Some of her hair had been cut. She had racial slurs of a type that I won't go into detail about on the program written on her in what appeared to be charcoal, and she had dog feces smeared on her. She was taken into the hospital. There were some officers and one of the emergency room doctors who immediately suspected that something was wrong because they did a test where she was supposedly unconscious. So they picked up her hand and held it over her face. Now, when they let go of her hand, being unconscious, her hand should fall down and smack herself right in the face. But it didn't. It moved to the side of her head, which was some indication that she was conscious. After a day or two, through a member of her family, she made public her allegations as to what had happened. She alleged that, I believe it was five men in total, all of whom were white, had basically kidnapped her, raped her, sodomized her, and treated her in a despicable way, solely because she existed as an African-American female. So this, of course, raised tremendous media coverage. Very prominent members of the national African-American community came out and got involved. Bill Cosby is an example. Now, he's had some problems in recent years, but back then, he was the king of the mountain. I mean, he was, a major Hollywood star. Everybody loved him. He came out in support. Mike Tyson, who at that time was the heavyweight champion of the world, he came out in support. A then young reverend named Al Sharpton, who had come to some prominence over a couple of matters down in the city, the Crown Heights matter and a few others, he came into Poughkeepsie and they began making all kinds of accusations. Eventually, accusations were made accusing one of the assistant district attorneys, a man named Pagonis. He was accused of being one of the perpetrators, as was an officer who had unfortunately become depressed and committed suicide named Christ. They accused him as well. Pagonis would later sue them for libel and slander. The difference, of course, libel is written, slander is verbal. And there was a significant judgment entered against them. But in any instance, so this is going on and there's tremendous media coverage. And shortly before the whole thing happened with Annie Cathcart, one of Sharpton's inner circle members came out publicly and made a statement that Tawana Browley wasn't telling the truth, that Reverend Sharpton and his supporters supposedly knew this, didn't care, and that they were simply exploiting it for their own political and perhaps financial gain. Sharpton and his supporters vehemently denied that. They ended up going on a New York program, television program that existed then called the Richard Bay Show, and they criticized that guy rather significantly and denied vehemently his allegations. So you've got a situation now where you've got tremendous racial strife that's going on in Poughkeepsie, which is about 21 to 22 miles south of Kingston. But the public is just starting to turn. It's starting to turn, and people are starting to think, maybe this is not what it appears to be. And now, the morning of July 12th, Annie Cathcart is found, and the body is found with the letters KKK carved into her legs and a K into her stomach. And when that came out, now suddenly Sharpton and his supporters pivoted to Kingston and began making accusations that the crimes were related, that the area was, their words, a, quote, Klan den, close quote, and they said that a racist cult was operating in the area and likely had committed both crimes. And so the media circus came to Kingston.
Now let's talk about how, before we talk about the crime scene itself and the murder scene and the description of Anna's body as she was murdered, there's a central character in here named Joseph Kernan. And he's a 42-year-old unemployed person with a history of mental illness, as you write, and well-known
yes.
to police.
Yeah.
Tell us how it comes that he comes to the attention of police, and you talk about the two nurses at the nearby, as you described, the very nearby hospital. So maybe you can also tell us the proximity of what we're talking about here, and what he finds and his interaction with the two nurses from the hospital that night, or the next day, I should say.
All right. Near the center of Kingston, there is a building that at that time was called Kingston Hospital. It is still today a hospital, but it has a different name. Although people here still call it Kingston Hospital because to lifelong Kingstonians, that's always what it was. Behind Kingston Hospital in the 1980s and earlier, there was a wooded area that had a large, for lack of a better term, a large trench had been dug out because for years there were railroad tracks that ran through there. In fact, those tracks were used up until 1975. At that time, they were owned by a company called Conrail, and they made the decision to no longer to use it, and it became abandoned. I can still remember from the house I grew up in for the first 7 years of my life, I can remember early on looking down and seeing those that train going by. But then when I was four, it went away. But I still remember that train because I remember it was you could go out in front of my house and look, and there it was. But when the train was abandoned, those train tracks were abandoned, nobody was maintaining that railway bed. So although the actual path itself where the tracks were was clear, the area around it was overgrown and so forth. And so this became a place, it ran right behind the hospital. And this became a place during the day where you'd see a lot of kids playing hooky from school and things like that. Some people used it as a shortcut to go places. But after dark, it was something different. You would see bums or homeless people going back there. People would go back there to drink, do drugs, engage in other activities. So it was not a place you really wanted to be after dark. It was also, there was very little light back there. What little light you'd get would be if you brought a flashlight or if there was some moonlight. So this was a pretty, when it got dark, it was a pretty spooky thing. In any instance, on the morning of July 12th, two nurses are walking up the road that ran along the side of Kingston Hospital. It was called Foxhole Avenue. Kingston Hospital is on the corner of Foxhole and Broadway. And you would go down Foxhole Avenue, and then on the as you went down it, on your left-hand side, you could see the entrance into the rail tracks. And it, even in daylight, it was very dark and gloomy. There's a picture of it I put in the book just to try to give people some idea that even in the daylight, this was a pretty gloomy, spooky-looking place because of all the overgrown brush overhead. So these two women are walking to work, nurses, as you mentioned, worked at the hospital. And they're on their way in, and out comes Kiernan. Now, Kiernan had the appearance of a homeless man or a bum. He wasn't homeless, but he had significant mental issues. He, as you mentioned, he had run-ins with the police. Never anything serious, minor stuff that you might expect from someone who has significant mental issues like trespassing and things like that. Nothing ever major. He wasn't a violent man by any stretch. He comes out of the wooded area. He's clearly upset. It's about 6:30 in the morning, and he tells the woman that he's found what he described. One woman said he used the term love doll. Another one said mannequin. He said it's either that or a body. So they told him to go to a payphone, which of course was broken, as they all were back in those days. But they eventually call the police, and when they all go back there, they find 19-year-old Annie Kithcart back there. She had been strangled, which they would find out later. It was obvious she'd been bludgeoned because part of her face around the orbital socket was basically crushed in. Her body had been stripped except for one moccasin and her brassiere, which was had been pushed over her breast but was still on her. And as we mentioned, she had the letters KKK carved into her legs and a large letter K carved into her stomach. It was a gruesome crime scene. I can tell you, the hardest part about doing this book was the day that I had a chance to look at the actual crime scene photographs. I wasn't looking forward to it. I didn't enjoy it because I knew her. I liked her. I thought she was a really sweet person. And I have worked very hard in many ways to push those out of my mind. But I had to see them in order to get a fair understanding of what the crime scene was. I really didn't think I could write a book and give any type of analysis if I didn't see them. I didn't want to, but I did. They were very disturbing, and I made it and I promised to myself I would not use them, and I didn't. There are some pictures in my book that show the crime scene, but they don't show her at the crime scene. I just couldn't do that to her family or to her memory. It was just, they were just horrible.
Now, you also talk about a piece of glass embedded in her neck.
Yeah, they found a piece of glass that was embedded in her neck. The belief is that glass was probably what was used. They don't know for certain, but the belief was that was probably what was used to make the scratches or the slice marks in her legs and stomach.
Now, you talk about the detectives, and Detective Crom, he notices signs of struggle, and you talk about the lacerations on her forehead and her face. What else does he find in terms of evidence? I mean, you say there's so much refuse and things there. The trash is there. But what do they assemble in terms of actual evidence, exhibits, what they think is evidence? And tell us what
that scene,
some of the things that they
there
find.
There was a second crime scene that I guess we'll talk about soon. But at that particular crime scene, tremendous number of things there. There was garbage. There was bottles. There were old clothes and some duffel bags and stuff. They took a lot of things. Some had relation to the crime, some didn't. One of the things they took, there was an orange plastic basin of the type you would see at a hospital, not surprisingly since they're behind one, and it was covered in blood. They took that. They took the moccasin that was there. They obviously they eventually collected the brassiere, although they left it on her body, and they left the glass in her neck until the coroner and the pathologist could do their job. They took dirt samples. They took samples of the blood. They took in leaves that had blood on them. Of course, they photographed everything. There's tons and tons of photographs that they took, as they're supposed to. No video. That wasn't done. That's not all that uncommon at that time. Now it's standard protocol. Then it was mostly photographs. And they took a whole variety of different things. I mean, they took in the neighborhood of like 30 to 40 specific items. Not all of them really had anything to do with the crime. But, you know, in that type of case, you got to be thorough.
Now, you also talk about what they could surmise by looking at the scene. You talk about you already mentioned another crime scene. So tell us what they could surmise and how they surmised what little they could deduce from this initial look at the crime scene and her without talking to anybody else like the pathologist or anyone else as of yet.
Well, they were pretty sure, as you mentioned, that there had been some kind of a scuffle because there was some areas that looked like they had been freshly moved about. One of the things I didn't mention that they took in evidence was they found two pieces of brick that had blood on it,
right,
which would later be suggested was the murder weapon. It was never definitively proven, but I think it's more likely than not it was. And it was broken in half, likely from the impact. And they were suspicious of that, so they took that into evidence. The police in their notes don't really go into much speculation. They kept it pretty much to the facts. I mean, I know from interviewing different people that there were some concerns right away that this was a racial crime. Annie was of mixed parentage. Her father was African-American. Her mother was Caucasian. Interestingly enough, and I mentioned this in the book, Annie never considered herself black or white. She considered herself both, and never in her life did anybody know of her ever having any trouble with that. But there were some thoughts it could be racial. There were some that thought, well, maybe this was a cover-up. For the most part, the police didn't really seem to let their reports reflect any type of speculation. They kept the reports very professional and very to the point, which turned out to be a good thing in light of all of the media circus and the wild accusations that would eventually be made by Sharpton and his supporters. But they at that point they believed at that point, and it would later be proven to be so, that the killer had taken the remainder of the clothes with him. Otherwise, they would obviously be there. They had to have been, although the reports don't discuss it in detail. There was some initial thought that maybe it had been sexual in nature. They couldn't tell just by looking at the body if there had been sexual abuse. There wasn't, they would later determine. But that was something that was also on their minds as well. And it's important in any type of investigation like that you keep an open mind and allow the evidence and the facts to lead you and not try to twist the evidence and the facts into what you need them to be to fit your theory.
Now, with this gruesome crime scene and this incredible murder with the additional KKK carved on her body, what do they do with Joseph Kiernan? What does he say? Tell us about what they think. What does he say? What does he say in response to what he found? And what's the police response?
Well, of course, they make sure they take him into custody. I mean, he has to be a suspect from the beginning because he's one of the ones that found the body. He told them initially, "I just found the body." And he told them that he had been sleeping the night before out in the woods. Quite some distance away, there's a large building. It's been called the almshouse. It's been called the poorhouse. It was actually the first municipal building that was built once the city of Kingston was formed. And he had slept behind that the night before. And then he said that he had walked when he got up at the crack of dawn. He broke camp, which for him was basically picking up his bedroll. Walked down the other railroad tracks that go through the city. And then once he got into Midtown, he turned. And he was supposedly heading to his mother's house. And the direction he was going was consistent with that. And he told them that he found the body, and he immediately reported it. Well, they were suspicious. He knew more than he was letting on. They didn't know whether he had done it or if he knew more, but they were questioning him a great deal. And, you know, he was not exactly the overly forthcoming, and they felt he was hiding something or that he just wasn't willing to talk. Eventually, they brought him to another city not too far away, about an hour away, called Middletown, where the state police had a barracks that had a polygraph machine, commonly known as a lie detector, which he agreed to take. And the person who did the test was convinced that he wasn't the killer, that he was telling the truth when he said he didn't kill her. But they felt that he was hiding something, and they pressured him and pressured him. And eventually, he made a statement contending that he had sexually abused the body after he had found it in a most disturbing manner. He, although it was not released to the public in detail, at least not until my book, because it was always just reported generically, but he was accused of briefly performing oral sex on the body, which is quite repulsive. As to whether he really did that or not, that I'm not going to reveal. That you have to read the book to find out. You know the answer to it because you've read it, but the listeners are going to have to read the book to get the answer to that, because I can definitively answer that. Whether he did or didn't. But so now it comes out. First you have, we get news that Annie's been killed. Then the news comes out a few days afterwards that she had been found with the KKK letters on her. And then news comes out that this person who found her has been arrested and charged with sexual abuse against a corpse. It was a strange few days, let me tell you.
Complicating this as well is that the police ask him if he saw the KKK, because they think, well, did you carve the KKK? And he said no, but he said he also, to complicate this, he said he didn't see the K and the KKK on both of her thighs.
First he said he didn't see it, and then when they pressed him on it, he said, "I won't say." And you have to understand, this guy is not someone who thought rationally. This was a guy who would tell anybody who would listen that he was a member of the CIA, that he was a member of Interpol, that he was undercover. Later, he would make a statement to the media that he had gone too far undercover and he let his hair grow too long. I mean, he was not a well man. And, I don't know what his actual diagnosis was. I can't get access to those types of records. They're private. I would suspect he was probably a paranoid schizophrenic, but I don't know for sure. But he had significant mental issues. And he could, had they pressed him hard enough, he might have admitted to the Kennedy assassination. I mean, you know, he just was not, he was just somebody that would say things that were outrageous from time to time. While he was in the jail, the local radio station was able to interview him, and that was an interesting experience. And of course, by then he had recanted his statement, and he was saying that he was a patsy, and they were trying to frame him, and so forth. And it was a, you know, and he was claiming that it had something to do with Tawana Brawley. And, you know, the police initially were suspicious of him, thinking that maybe he had put the KKK letters on it, on the body. And that was highlighted later because I mentioned the Brawley case earlier. There was an ongoing investigation. The governor had appointed Robert Abrams, the New York Attorney General at that time, to put together a special grand jury to investigate. And he had put together a hotline that people could send in information. Well, according to the reports from the Attorney General, he let them know that Kiernan had actually called that line claiming he had some information. It was never disclosed what that information was. But whatever it was, they investigated it and it came up negative. So here he had somebody who had apparently tried to get involved in the Brawley case. And then he's involved here with a body that's found with those types of marks. And so there was a lot of suspicion that he might have been the one that put the letters on her. So, you know, this was not a well man, to say the least.
Now you add this with other people with agendas and, again, suspicions and ties to the Brawley case. And because he has claimed that this is connected to the Brawley case, not that the attorney Maddox would necessarily need too much motivation, but tell us about, he has a lawyer, but then tell us about the role of attorney Maddox in this case representing Kiernan.
Well, initially Maddox came into town with Al Sharpton and they went right up to the jail and they interviewed him. They initially said they were not going to take the case, but they were going to investigate. They were going to help the public defender's office, who was assigned to represent Mr. Kiernan. And that's how it went for a while. Eventually, he became the attorney for Mr. Kiernan. And he had a remark that I actually, when I read it, I burst out laughing. He, after it was announced he had taken the case, there was an appearance in court, and the media didn't know he was going to take the case. And all of a sudden, there he was, and he was representing him. And after Kiernan had left and gone back to the jail, they were yelling out questions, and they asked him, well, how did you come to represent Mr. Kiernan? And he said, well, I don't know. He must have looked me up in the Yellow Pages. You know, so
sure.
He was a man, you can say what you want about him, but he did have a very sharp wit. He wasn't stupid by no means, or any means, I should say. But, you know, he made a lot of statements. He made statements. He actually had one statement where he said that only the police could have put the body where it was found, which is although he didn't say it directly, that suggests that he was insinuating that the police had something to do with it. He cited a false report from a Fox News station. I don't mean the modern Fox News, but the Fox Network.
Right.
Back then, it was just getting started, and it was different than Fox News, the modern Fox News. And there was a news reporter who said that Annie had been chased by the police that night, which was incorrect. And he harped on that as part of the allegation as well. And he reached an outrageous conclusion, and it was reported, you know, by the local papers, and it didn't make the police particularly happy, that's for sure.
Now, you talk about the police telling officers not to talk to the media because they know that this is a hot case, and there's a powder keg of tension already going on anyway. Sharpton's hanging around or threatening to come around. But the police have to do their job and do a canvas and find out more about Annie and her whereabouts that day, about her background as well, so that they know who they can speak to. And then there's obviously a tip line set up as well. So while police are canvassing and they're doing their due diligence in terms of finding out about Annie, what do they find out about her and what do they start getting a picture of maybe how she came to meet her fate that evening?
Well, as you mentioned, they do a canvas, and they also were looking into what she had done that day. They knew that she, they talked to her friend that she'd been with, a woman named Denise, and some other people she was with throughout the day. She and Denise had gone out. Annie was looking for a job that day. Like a lot of, I shouldn't say kid, because 19 is legal and adult, but knowing how I and a lot of my friends were at 19, I still use the word kid because, quite frankly, a lot of us were.
Yeah.
And, but she was in a position, like a lot of kids at that age who had been partying it up and enjoying herself. Reports accused her of being an addict of some kind, and that's simply not true. She did drink. She liked to party. She was known to smoke a joint now and again. And as was very prominent in the 1980s, powder cocaine was very much almost like marijuana then. It was very prominent.
Yeah.
And she did recreationally use that, not a lot, but occasionally. And in the last 6 months of her life, she had been partying enough that her friends had noticed and had said something to her. And like a lot of kids who do that, they have to make the choice. Are they going to continue to do that, or are they going to straighten things up, finish growing up and maturing, and get on with their lives? By all accounts, that's what Annie had decided to do. She was out looking for a job that day. She had told people she was going to go back and finish high school and get her GED and, you know, get her life moving. They found out that she had met up with some friends. They were going to go to a carnival uptown on the other side of the city that was there every July, and is still there, in fact, every July. And on the way there, they stopped at a store called Convenient Mart, a little, you know, small, exactly what it sounds like, a small convenience store.
Sure.
And they went in, and it appears that they were looking to get some beer. They weren't going to be able to buy because they were underage. And Annie ended up taking a 40-ounce bottle of beer. And the clerk caught them. And the one friend that was with her kind of betrayed her and turned on her and said, "I don't know who this person is. She's not with me." And Annie panicked, and she ran with the bottle across the street and hit it. And her friends were stuck around. The police came, took a statement, and then they left. But they went up to the carnival, and Annie was left on her own for the rest of the evening. And she spent the rest of the evening bumping into different people she saw. And every person she saw, she basically said, "Hey, you want to hang out? Do you want to get a drink?" You know, she was just looking for companionship mostly the whole night, just to, you know, to do something and to have someone to hang out with. And she was last seen at approximately 2:30 in the morning near a bar that she had been in and out of all night called the Royal Grill. And based on where she was heading, the only place really she could have gone was this alley between a store called Cheap Charlie's, which was a little place where you could buy cigarettes and things like that, and the Royal Grill. And that alley led to a street called Jansen Avenue, and that Jansen Avenue went right to Foxhole Avenue and was directly across the street. It actually ended, and you'd be facing, looking at the entrance to the old railway bed where she was eventually found. Ironically, at one point, she went down the railway bed earlier that evening with the man she knew from school, and they drank some of the beer that that she had found, or that she had taken, I should say. And then they went back, and she went back to the bar, and the guy went home. So they had a pretty good knowledge of where she was. There was one witness that said she saw her with a man that was later identified as the defendant, Jeff Dawson. She actually, at a different point, saw another man with the same name, Jeff Dawson, who was actually their cousins. And ironically, she had asked him, "Do you want to," the younger Jeff Dawson, she asked, "Do you want to hang out?" And he said, "I can't. I have to get up." Turns out he was going up to the carnival as well, and his friends were planning to meet him. She just didn't know it. Had she known that, she might have gotten the car, and this might not have happened. So they knew, basically, you know, Annie was well-liked, that she had been partying recently, and they knew most of her movements up until shortly before she was killed.
Now, I mentioned the tip line, obvious, that police would have set up for anyone that might have information to make an anonymous call. How many days after this murder, and again with all this turmoil and not many leads really, what do police receive in terms of a tip from where they find out later is a person named Penny DeGroat? But let's talk about what that call entails and what the police discover from that phone call.
Well, they got it within the first 24 to 48 hours. They got a phone call, an anonymous call from a woman. It came from a hamlet called Port Ewan, which is 5 minutes, if that, from the city of Kingston. It's right across the Rondell Creek, and it's next door. They got a phone call. They traced it to a phone booth, and all the call, it was a woman, and she just said, the girl that was found by the hospital, Jeff Dawson did it. And she hung up. So they had no idea who it was. They heard the name. They didn't know if it meant anything. But it became, they went back to it not long thereafter, because when they were doing the canvassing, they started hearing from people rumors that there was somebody out there who was bragging that he had done it. And so they asked around, and they eventually traced it to a woman who lived right on Jansen Avenue. And she told them, to which she had to make some calls to see if it was okay for her to tell the police, and she eventually did. She told them that she had heard about it from Penny DeGroat and her boyfriend, Todd Schlied. And so the police went out to where they lived, which was about 10 or 15 miles outside of Kingston, had them come into the station, and they began to question them. And the story they told was quite interesting. They said that I don't want to say the day after the murder. It was the day of, but she died early in the morning, somewhere between 2:30 a.m. and 4 o'clock in the morning, probably around 3. But later that day, in the afternoon of that day, Todd Schlied and his girlfriend were driving down Broadway, and maybe 2 blocks before they got to the Kingston Hospital, they saw Jeff Dawson. And so because they were friends, they asked him to get in the car, and he got in the back, and they started driving. So they're talking about this or that. And then Schlied makes the left turn onto Foxhall Avenue. Now, as I mentioned before, Foxhall Avenue is the road that goes right by the entrance, one of the entrances, at least, to the old railway bed. And as they go by, the police are there. There's cars there. They've got the area taped off, and the police officers on guard, guarding the scene, as they should. And as they go by, Schlied and DeGroat told the police that Dawson immediately slid sideways in the seat and laid down so he couldn't be seen in the car. And he said something along the lines of, I think they're looking for me. So they continue driving, and eventually they get to Jeff Dawson's home. And Jeff gets out of the car, and so does Todd. And Todd says he's talking to him, and he asks him, well, why are they looking for you? And he said, well, you know that, I won't use the word, but you know that blank Annie Kithgard? Well, yeah, I do. I murdered her last night. So Todd Schlied himself, like Dawson, had a significant criminal history. It was all burglaries. In his case, unlike Jeff Dawson, it also involved drugs. Dawson's crimes really were burglaries of businesses and so forth, which Schlied did too, but he also had some drug offenses, but never murder. And that was something that was of a level of crime above what he was used to and comfortable, and it obviously bothered him, and he immediately told Penny about it. And after discussing it, they decided the way they would soothe their conscience was for Penny to make the anonymous call. And they figured, you know, that the police will investigate him now and they'll catch him. So what the police decided to do, having heard all of this, they asked Todd to wear a wire, and he agreed. And a bunch of police officers in unmarked cars went into the neighborhood all around Jeff Dawson's home, and Schlied and his girlfriend drove their own car over, and he ended up engaging in a conversation that was recorded, not the greatest quality, and there was a lot of had to be enhanced, at least as best they could in those days, but he basically was pushing him to make a statement, and he did, although what he said was not consistent with the physical evidence, but he eventually said on the tape, he said, yeah, I pushed her, and she hit her head, and I made it look like a crazy person did it. And so then, of course, they immediately arrested him and brought him down and started the interrogation. And that's how Jeff Dawson became more than a person of interest. He became a suspect and actually was arrested and charged. And that's how it progressed from that simple anonymous phone call.
Well, that's great. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a moment to talk about our sponsor of this program, Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system setting the highest standards for ingredients and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron offers three meal plans. Two-person meal plan serves two people. Choose from eight new recipes per week with the choice to receive two or three recipes any week. There's a family meal plan, serves four. Choose from four new recipes per week. And there's a wine plan now. Six bottles of wine from renowned winemakers delivered monthly. Gourmet meals delivered right to your home. All the fresh ingredients for less than $10 per meal. Seasonal recipes to make your own gourmet meals. For 8 weeks ending February 26, Blue Apron is teaming with Whole30 to bring you delicious recipes. Blue Apron's menu will feature two Whole30 approved recipes each week, such as seared steak and warm lemon salsa verde with roasted broccoli and sweet potato, and chicken and kale orange salad with spicy tahini dressing. Kick your new year off with Blue Apron and Whole30. I tried the vegetable fried rice with Togarashi peanuts. Really, the unique combination of ingredients and spices. I would have never thought of anything like this. It was delicious. Blue Apron delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients, step-by-step recipes right to your door that can be cooked in under 45 minutes. The menu changes every week based on what is in season and is designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team. Blue Apron sends only non-GMO ingredients and meat without added hormones. Now, Blue Apron is treating True Murder listeners to $30 off your first order if you visit blueapron.com/truemurder. That's blueapron.com/truemurder. $30 off your first order. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now, we talked about, Richard, that Jeff Dawson has now been tape recorded making admissions. You say that there is some inconsistencies in what he says. So let's talk about what the police do, how they interview him, investigate his background. Tell us how that proceeds.
Well, after he was arrested, he was brought in and he was interrogated by two detectives, Detective Spitalieri and Detective Junius Harris. And Harris kind of played the good cop, if you will, in that he wasn't the one really leading the interrogation. He kind of sat back, and every once in a while he'd ask a follow-up, and he kind of talked about, you know, I've known you since you were a little boy. I know your family. I mean, you have to understand, Kingston's right. A small city, and in those days in particular, just about everybody either knew everybody or knew of everybody. And you know, you might not know, let's say, John Smith, but you'd say, oh, yeah, that's Maggie Smith's boy. And, you know, you kind of knew somebody. And Junius Harris was one of those guys who knew everybody. And so he kind of played that angle and did it very well, actually. And they began questioning him. And he made a statement right away. And he said, and I've actually heard the audio. The audio still exists. And it's a very interesting listen. He said that he ran into Annie, he saw her at the Royal Grill, and he said that he left the Royal Grill, and then he saw her again near the entrance to the rail bed. And she was saying, come on, you want to do something. Now, they knew each other. In fact, Annie's sister was in a relationship with somebody who was related to Jeff Dawson. So they knew who each other were. They didn't really hang in the same circles because Jeff was in his upper 20s and Annie was 19. But they knew who each other were. So she was saying, come on, let's do something. And he didn't want to. He was going somewhere. And eventually he said she was starting to annoy him, and he eventually said, pushed her away, get away from me. And he said she got angry and came at him again. Come on, let's do something. And he said he pushed her again, and he claimed she fell, hit the back of her head, and she didn't move. Now, he said she thought, his exact words were, I thought she was playing, meaning I thought she was pretending. He said he reached down, and when his hand came, you know, lifted the back of her head, he said when his hand came back, he claimed he panicked at that point, that he tried to check her for a pulse, but he couldn't tell if she had one because his own pulse was racing. And he then took off, and he went out the other side, which went to a street called East O'Reilly, and he circled around up to a building that was called Old City Hall. That was the original city hall. It was abandoned in the early 1970s, and it had been allowed to sit there and decay all those years. It was completely abandoned. In the year 2000, it was refurbished and became City Hall again, which was nice because it's a beautiful building. But at that time, it was abandoned. And he said he just sat there on the steps for about 2 hours, which would have made it to about 5 o'clock in the morning. He said he went back to check on her, and when he got back, he said somebody else must have come along because she had been stripped and cut, and her clothes were sitting there in a pile. He said so he still had the blood on his own hand, and he had wiped it on his shirt, so he took his own shirt off and said he took the clothes, and he went off, and he left the clothes in an alley where they were later found, and which was the second crime scene that I was talking about. And he said that, kept saying, when I left her, she was alive. And the police, jumped on that and said, you know, that can't be true. But he stuck to it. They didn't accept it, and I don't either. It just is so far-fetched to believe that he left her there, and then, it was so dark in there that if somebody's laying on the ground, you might not even see them. If you didn't know she was there, you might not have seen her because it was pitch black. And to believe that somebody came along, saw her, and just said, hey, I know, I'll kill her and strip her, it just doesn't make any sense. But that was the story he told, and he stuck to it throughout. And he told anybody who would listen that she was alive when I left. But his admissions were still significant in that he put himself in the alley with Annie, in the railway, I should say, the railway bed, with Annie Cathcart around the time of her death. And he admitted he pushed her and caused injury to her, although there were no significant cuts in the back of her head, so it was inconsistent. There was a cut on her ear, and I suppose the blood could have run from her ear down to the back of her head, so he may very well have seen blood and just have been wrong about where it came from. But he put himself in that place, so it was very strong evidence against him, because now they had him, not only people saying that he had bragged about it, but now they had him admitting he was in the area with her at the time, around the time she died. So it was pretty significant evidence.
The idea right away, once they have Jeff Dawson, and he's black and this woman is biracial, doesn't have much credibility to the Al Sharpton and Alton Maddox contention, does it, at that time?
No, and in fact, right after he was arrested, the district attorney held a press conference and announced that there is no racial motive here. Although he was asked, did Dawson put the KKK marks? And at that point, they still thought Kiernan did. And they said, well, it's possible Kiernan did. And this allowed Sharpton and Maddox to continue to say that Kiernan was a patsy, and it was part of the reason why Maddox stuck around and represented Kiernan, at least for a while. And although up until the time he was disbarred, he may have tactically still represented him. I don't know. But they were quick to get it out there that this was not a racial crime, but they were by no means sure that Dawson was the one who put the KKK marks. They thought it might have been Kiernan at that point.
He did have his wife, Rose Dawson, did provide an alibi for him initially, didn't she? How did police just break that alibi? What did they do with that?
I'd mentioned it in the timeline. I'd mentioned that they got the call, anonymous call, and that later, within about 24 hours after that, they had heard that there was somebody bragging, and they confirmed who it was. Well, they did send a detective after they got the tip just to talk to him, and he wasn't at home, but he and his wife came down to the police station, and they gave a statement saying, well, he had been in the Royal Grill. He had stopped in earlier in the evening, played a game of Pac-Man, but he had left, gone home, and he had stayed at home the rest of the night. And his wife said, yeah, that was true. So at that point, they said, okay, and they let him go. Then when they got the extra piece of information, had Schlied wear the wire and they arrested him, they also brought in his wife, and his wife eventually admitted, yes, she had not been truthful and that she was providing an alibi. But in fact, he had gone out himself after that. He was at the Royal Grill. They did go home, but he wasn't home all night. He had gone back out. And they actually eventually at the trial forced her to testify to that, to not only to prove that he had the opportunity, but also to get it out there indirectly that Dawson had lied to the police and given a fake alibi. Why would you give a fake alibi unless you needed to cover up something you had done untoward?
All right. Now, obviously, there's enough to – you talk about the procedure to be able to get this to trial, to be able to prosecute him. Let's just fast forward to really, I mean, his contention that he – that she banged her head accidentally is the contention that she died accidentally. He didn't kill her. He didn't have that intent, which complicates this entire thing. So the pathologist and the medical examiner are crucial in this. So let's fast forward to this prosecution, and what do each one of these crucial expert witnesses have to say, which
– well.
Is in contrast
doctors.
To what – okay, go ahead, sorry.
I'm sorry. They had two doctors that testified. One was a forensic pathologist and the other was the coroner. And they disagreed about something that really was important in my thought process because it changed the entire nature of it depending on what had happened. Both of them agreed that Annie died as a result of both the choking and the manual strangulation and the blunt force trauma. And both agreed that they found was consistent with what could have been the murder weapon. They weren't able to say it was, but they could say it was consistent. They both agreed that the KKK marks were made at least at the beginning while she was alive, but the last one on one leg was after she had died. So her heart, they could tell because the there was no blood flow, the heart had stopped beating. So, but where they disagreed was whether she was choked first or whether she was bludgeoned first. And this becomes important. If she was choked first, then you can theorize a scenario where they got into an argument, he grabbed her in a choke lock. And many people think that a choke lock will take a long time before you go out. And that's not necessarily true. I know from personal experience, since I regularly take judo, that if a choke is hit just right, you can go out within a second, if even that. And he was a strong man, and she wasn't frail by any stretch, but she was not a big woman. She was thin, and if he caught it just right, that choke just right, she would go right out. So you could argue a scenario that he choked her, she went unconscious, he panicked. And then, according to his words, made it look like a crazy person did it. And the real tragedy there would be him thinking she was dead and she's not. And this occurred within a couple hundred yards of the emergency room. So he could have picked her up and carried her over there, and maybe she survives, which is even more sad. The other scenario, however, if the bludgeoning occurred first, there really isn't any way to argue manslaughter. You can't exactly argue that it was an unintentional death if it starts off with you beating somebody over the head with a brick. It just doesn't follow. And then the incredible savagery that you're thinking of if after the beating with the brick, he then picks her up and then chokes her while her whole head is caved in. I mean, it creates a very different impression of who this person is. I believe that the former is what happened, that I think the choking occurred first based on – you know, Jeff Dawson's background, who he was, and a few other things. But if it was the reverse, if that other expert was right, you're looking at a cold, vicious killer at that point. It presents a very different scenario, and yet that the experts disagreed about it.
Now, the idea that the pathologist would weigh in to say definitively what happened, let's go to the issues at trial that you point out, because there are quite a few. And he's represented, Dawson is represented by capable an attorney. So you have this Kavanaugh and his attorney. So tell us sort of the dynamics that's there and some of the issues that are being raised during this trial.
Well, I think the most interesting thing when you start looking at it were the two strategies that they had. I mentioned that there was the audio recording of the interrogation, which was very powerful stuff, where Dawson put himself in the alley with her. Mike Kavanaugh made the decision not to use that in his case in chief. Now, Mike Cavanaugh is an excellent prosecutor. I have tremendous respect for him. I've known him for a long time. He went on to become a New York State Supreme Court judge and is now retired. The only logical reason to not use that tape in your case in chief was that he believed strongly enough that the defendant was going to testify, that the theory would be to try to argue manslaughter and get less of a sentence than murder, because that what is going to be the biggest weakness of their case is if he said, no, I choked her first, it was an accident, and he admitted that he did it, and the argument was about whether or not he intended it and so forth, there would have been a legitimate chance to get a manslaughter conviction as opposed to murder. However, what Kavanaugh didn't know, and he couldn't know because he's not privy to it, was Dawson had no intention of pleading to anything, and their strategy from the beginning was to go for an acquittal. So once he finished his case, Dawson didn't testify. In fact, they only called one defense witness, and it was a police officer, and it was just designed to get some information to try to preclude some things, and it was to try to shore up something on an appeal because the judge had denied certain things, and that was it. He didn't really present a defense. He was just going to argue that the evidence was insufficient, and they didn't have a lot of evidence. Now, if this case occurred today, a very different scenario, because the forensics are so much better today than they were in 1988 and during the trial in 1989. There was a lot of blood, and yet more often than not, they couldn't even type it. The only blood they were able to actually get a typing for was the blood that was found in the orange basin I mentioned before, and it was covered in blood. Nowadays, you can not only get typing, but you can get DNA from a drop. DNA was in its absolute infancy. It was rarely used at that point, and they didn't even try it, and they probably wouldn't, except for the one basin, they may not even had enough based on the way it was done back then to do DNA. So without that, the only blood that they typed was consistent with Annie's blood and not consistent with the defendant. So they really didn't have a lot of blood evidence to go with. There was a bite mark that they bruised that was believed to be a bite, and they brought in a dentist, Dr. Mobson, who testified that he felt that the defendant caused the bite. Although I thought Lippman, probably his best cross-examination was the cross-examination of the defendant, I mean of the dentist, I should say, in that he really assailed the bite, and he got the witness to say, well, if he only bit her once, it's not consistent, and he tried to come up with this theory that he had bitten her, that she had moved during the bite, and that doesn't really make any sense because if he beat her over the head first, she's unconscious, but both doctors admit that. And if he choked her first, it's that might account for the bite, but why are you going to bite while you're choking? That doesn't make any sense. So I wasn't overly impressed with it, but that was the only physical scientific evidence that they tried to connect Dawson to it, was that bite mark. And considering the time period, there was another prominent serial killer that had been convicted largely on bite mark evidence down in Florida. And so that was in the news a lot, and it was difficult to really convince the jury that this wasn't great evidence. As I've mentioned in the book, as the years have gone on, there have been a number of cases where bite mark evidence was the basis of a conviction, and once they could do DNA, they found out the person didn't do it. So, and in Texas, there's been a call for a moratorium on it. And Texas is not exactly known as a criminal defendant's paradise. It's considered to be a prosecutor's paradise. And yet even there, they're talking about a moratorium on that type of evidence. So, so it would have been a different case today, but both sides had some interesting arguments to make, and it ended up going to the jury with both sides thinking they had a shot.
When you talk about the pathologist's testimony, though, to discredit the testimony of Dawson, to say that this was an accident, that he had found blood on the back of the head, explain what those conclusions were and how that really discounted what Dawson had said in the statement.
Okay. Actually, the jury must have been pretty confused because they didn't understand why he kept asking about the back of his head, because they never heard Dawson saying that he touched the head. But he did have him state over and over again there were no bruises, significant bruises in the back of the head that showed a lot of blood, because in the statement that he likely intended to use to impeach Dawson if he testified, Dawson said he put his hand under the back of her head, and it came back to this blood. What Lippman tried to point out was she had a significant cut on the side of her ear. And there was an argument about whether or not that could have been caused by her falling on a stick. The witness kept saying, no, she had to be struck with a stick. I didn't find that particularly credible, because if you're hit by the stick, either by it being swung or you fall on it with enough force, there's not a lot of difference there. And if, you know, she was found on her back, so the blood, you know, from the ear could easily have rolled back down her neck. And as he reached under, that could have been the blood he got on his hand in theory. But it was a lot of argument back and forth on that. It never really became significant for the jury because, as I said, Dawson didn't testify and they never heard the tape.
Now, Lippman is making just strides, it seems. You rate the days of the trial even when he makes a significant win or he makes significant points or gains, mm-hmm. where Kavanaugh maybe misses an opportunity or where Lippman capitalizes on an opportunity. So you talk about that he really is going for this full acquittal, which Kavanaugh is not really aware of. So he's really just trying to make points where there might be reasonable doubt in that jury. That's really all he's trying to do, isn't it?
Yes. And let me just add something. You're right when you say that I point out, well, there was a mistake here, and why did this one do that? Even as an attorney myself, I have to recognize it's easy for me to look back on a trial, looking
sure.
at a cold record and reading it, and be able to do that. It is a completely different thing, and I've been there as an attorney. When you are actually in the heat of battle, and you're going
sure.
back and forth, much more difficult to make those decisions and those calls and so forth. And even some of the best attorneys out there are going to do things that people are going to look at and say, geez, why did you do that? You know, the idea of Dawson testifying was a very reasonable conclusion. I would have put the tape in just because I prefer to keep the defendant off the stand generally because, you know, the jury is always told not to take it into consideration that the defendant didn't testify, but they always do, even though they're not supposed to. So my preference would have been to put it in, but I understand what Mike Kavanaugh was doing. He was setting a trap for the defendant, and the defendant just decided not to testify. The other reason he didn't want to testify is because the jury would have found out in some detail about his prior record. There was a mistake made by Mr. Lippman that allowed some of that information to get to the jury, which by that may have, you know, made it easier for him to testify. But, you know, there were mistakes on both sides. But when you're in the heat of battle like that, that can happen. And I don't want people to think that I don't think highly of either man. I didn't know Mr. Lippman. He was pretty much retired by the time I started practicing. But Mike Kavanaugh I've known for a long time, and I have a great deal of respect for him. So I can understand how these things happen in the heat of battle because the pressure is on. I mean, here you are as a prosecutor trying to get justice for Annie, and her family's there and very much wants to see justice done. And on the other hand, as a defense attorney, you've got this guy's life in your hands. He's going to spend the rest of his life likely in jail if you lose. It's a lot of pressure, and it's not an easy thing to be in that situation. I've been there on both sides. It's difficult.
No, more of it's not, again, mistake is probably too big a word because it's more of minor missteps. Again, in retrospect, it's easy to say, well, that was done, but it's almost a flawless performance by both people, and you just point out where there was just that advantage that from one attorney to the other and from witness to witness. Now, we talked about...
There was only one that I thought was a blunder. There was one that I thought was particularly bad, and that was where the defense attorney, Mr. Lippman, allowed the jury to learn through his own mistake that his client had a criminal record. That was pretty bad.
Oh, sure. Yes.
That was a blunder.
Absolutely.
I even call it a blunder in the book. That was bad. The others, are questions of strategy and, like I said, mm-hmm. minor things in the heat of battle, but that one was a blunder.
What about the decision not to insinuate or intimate that Joseph Kiernan could have been the murderer? What do you think of Lippman's reluctance to do that?
He has since retired and lives in Mexico now, so I didn't get a chance to interview him. I would have loved to have asked him that, because were I the defense attorney, I would have been screaming at the top of my lungs that, you know, Kiernan was the suspect, was the murderer. You had a man who has clear mental issues. He doesn't have any real alibi for the time prior. He says he was sleeping in the woods, which there was some support of that, but who, even with the support they had, who knew what time he actually got up? He had made statements to the police at one point where he admitted doing a perverted thing with the body. There was an article in the paper where the police chief had stated that Kiernan had actually admitted at one point to cutting the body. He then recanted it. So you got a crazy person who's in this, who's there. And the only thing that was done when Kavanaugh gave his closing, he said, well, you know, we have his clothes. There wasn't blood found on his clothes. Well, on the pair of jeans that they found in Mr. Dawson's home with the service of a warrant, they found basically like a dot of blood, and that was it. And they tried to say, well, it was washed away because that night he swam in a pool and washed it off. Well, even then they used luminol, and luminol would have lit it up like a tree even if he had swam in a pool. So, you know, been screaming from the top of my lungs that Kiernan was the suspect, and I don't understand why he didn't. There must have been a reason. I would have loved to have spoken with him and find out, but that's something that should have been argued, in my opinion. But then again, like I said, it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback.
Now, one of the most interesting and just dramatic and sort of visual things is Jeff Dawson's wife, Rose, and her involvement in this whole thing. And you say she was there all the time, sitting behind him, supporting him, and you tell about her response, but she's a really good, effective prosecution witness against her husband. So tell us a little bit about what she actually says. I found it interesting. She even talks about what he looked like, what he was wearing. Tell us about her testimony and how important it was to this case.
Well, there were two major parts of her testimony. One was, and she was a reluctant witness, but the one was that he had lied about his initial alibi, that he was out and about after they went home, and he went back out, so he did have the means to do so. So, and it also showed he had lied to the police, and it never looks good for a defendant when it's shown that he lied to the police. The second thing was she said that he had been wearing a white cap that evening, skull cap type cap, and she mentioned that he had been wearing blue pants. They had recovered a pair of blue jeans, and they were trying to get her to say at trial that he was wearing blue jeans, and she said no, it wasn't blue jeans. It was a different type of blue pants, and they argued about that quite a bit. But basically, her major part of her testimony was that he lied to the police, and he was out and about and had the opportunity to commit the crime. And you know, when that's coming from your wife, that doesn't look good to a jury.
What was the significance of the T-shirt that was found within Annie's clothes, and then her testimony that he came home without a shirt? Or did I get this wrong?
That
tell,
doesn't help,
tell us about this.
Well, as I had mentioned, there was a second crime scene. The day they were out and that this all happened, they eventually got a call, and they went into the alley. It was the same alleyway that I had mentioned between Cheap Charlie's and Royal Grill, and they found a pile of clothes. They were identified as Annie Kithcart's clothes. They were bloody, and there was a white man's T-shirt that was there that was covered in blood, and they did find some hair evidence that was consistent with Jeff Dawson on that shirt, and you know, it was good evidence in that her testifying that he came home without a shirt was such that that obviously he had lost his shirt somewhere, he had taken it off, so it supported the idea that this was his shirt with the clothes. And
right.
You know, once the jury hears this and it reaches the conclusion that his clothes were with the clothes of the person who was murdered, what other reason would there be for him to get rid of his shirt than, you know, he got blood all over it? And the idea that he wiped his hands on the shirt really didn't follow. That, you know, the idea was that he had blood on his shirt that splashed on him while he was killing him, you know, beating him with the brick.
In this trial as well, You talk again. You talk about Rose being there. Who are the people that were surprisingly absent from this trial in your mind?
Well, some of Dawson's family weren't always there. There were different members of Annie's family that were there. Her mother testified, and that was a very difficult day for them.
Sure.
By the end, it was pretty much Dawson's wife and Dawson's sister that was there. But it isn't easy to see a family member, on trial like that. And there were some that were there and some that were not. Over the years, I've seen different trials where you would think certain family members are there and they're not, either because they can't handle the idea of hearing about a loved one who was killed, or they just can't keep their emotions in check while a loved one is on trial. So not necessarily shocking that you'll see family members from both sides not there from time to time, because the emotions on both sides can often be overwhelming.
Now, it was established that she was killed between 2 and 4. That was raised in the trial as well. What we didn't mention is the attitude that Jeff Dawson had towards his attorney, Lippman. What was it?
He didn't like him.
Tell us about that.
Well, Lippman was his third attorney. The first attorney he had was a man named Jerry Flattery, and he actually liked Jerry Flattery, and it's not surprising. Jerry's a very prominent criminal defense attorney. He had to withdraw because he said he had a conflict that required him to withdraw. And to this day, he's never discussed it, which just shows that he's an ethical attorney. But in all likelihood, he had a client who told him that he and Todd Schlied had committed some robberies and so forth. But in order to use that information to try to impeach Todd Schlied, he would have had to give up his client. So after that, there was another attorney, and he didn't last very long. He was out relatively quickly. And then finally, County Court Judge Vogt told him, this is your last attorney, so if you fire this guy, you're on your own. They didn't really get along very well. The media was constantly questioning Dawson as he would go back to jail. He'd be brought out of the courthouse to the waiting police van, and he'd make comments about how bad his attorney was and so forth. And, they'd ask Lippman about it. And to Lippman's credit, he would say things like, I'm not going to discuss the case. I'm not going to discuss that. And he would ignore it, which couldn't have been easy. I mean, here you got somebody that's questioning your ability, questioning your ethics, which is no fun when somebody does that. But you have to be able to not respond to that, because if you do that, you're attacking your own client, and that's contrary to what you're supposed to do. It sounds easy, but let me assure you, it's not.
Now, you talk about the decision, January 19th, 1989, and if it looks like a slam dunk, the jurors are deliberating and people are awaiting that decision, but when they have notes coming from the jury to clarify things, people are really get tense about things like that, that there might be some reasonable doubt, don't they? And so what were some of the things that they were asking for clarification during that time?
Well, the first thing that they came back in is they wanted to hear the recordings of the conversation that had been done between the defendant and Todd Schlied, his friend who wore the wire. And it was the original tape, and then there was the scientifically enhanced one. So, when that came out and they heard it was playing for them, there was, there's always speculation about what the jurors are thinking and whether, people always say, oh, that's good for the prosecution, that's good for the defense. No one really knows for sure. But obviously they were focusing on that. So some people thought, well, that's good for the defense, because if they're focusing on that, maybe they're not considering the other evidence that's out there. So in any instance, so they go back in. They also requested a chalkboard and chalk. That was given to them. And they go back and they deliberate. Then they come out and they're asking for a clarification about the law. Now, in this case, the judge charged intentional murder, meaning killed with intent. He also charged manslaughter know, the idea of an accidental death and so forth. And they were asking for, they also charged what they call depraved indifference murder, which is kind of between the two. It's the equivalent of intentional murder, but it's a different theory. It means you may not have acted with intent to kill, but your conduct was so outrageous and so reckless and so depraved to human life that it was obvious that death could occur and you just didn't care. So they had to go through all of that. So that now there's some thought about, well, maybe they're not going to go with the intentional murder. Maybe they're going to come back with manslaughter. And, you know, they had some more, they came back another time for some testimony again about that conversation. They eventually were ordered dinner. And then after that, they finally came back and they had a verdict. But it took quite a while. A lot of people were expecting it would be over quick, but it wasn't.
And the verdict was what in the end?
They found him, well, the first charge they had to talk about was intentional murder. They wouldn't get to the other charges unless they found him not guilty. And Foreman announced they had found him guilty of murder in the second degree, the first count. And so there was nothing else to ask them other than the traditional polling of the jury, which for non-attorneys who were listening, what that means is in order to confirm that it's unanimous, the defense will ask the judge to question each juror individually, what is your verdict? And you'll have each one of them say guilty, guilty, guilty. And 999,000 times out of a million, you're going to have all 12 saying guilty. But once in a while, you get somebody that hedges or says, I can't do this. So the defense always asks for it. But it's very, very rare to see it not happen. I've never seen it happen. But I saw one where a guy hedged a little bit, but he eventually said, no, he's, and that was it. And there actually was an appeal on that, but on a completely different case. But so they asked them for the polling. They all confirmed it. And then the case was adjourned for sentencing, and that was the end of the trial, except for sentencing sometime later.
You write about, meanwhile, because people haven't forgotten about this Joseph Kernan, and tell us about the charges that are laid on him, and then what happens to every single one of his hearings with Alton Maddox as his attorney?
Well, they kept coming back to have what they call a Huntley hearing. A Huntley hearing is a pretrial hearing to determine whether or not the statement given by the defendant to the police was voluntary. You know, although you're allowed to trick them into making statements, you can't beat it out of them, and the statement has to be voluntary. So they were going to have this hearing, and they kept Dawson and Kiernan at this point was out on bail, and he kept showing up every time, but Maddox didn't. And each time there was an excuse given, he was in court. On another matter, and they confirmed it. In fact, one time he was actually representing Al Sharpton on that. And he didn't show, Finally, he shows up. But Dawson's not, or I keep saying Dawson, he's getting tired. Kiernan isn't there. And they said, well, where is he? And Maddox says, well, he went to California. Now, this is in front of Judge Bruin in city court, because in New York, misdemeanors are tried in local court, except under very rare circumstances. So Judge Bruin in city court, now he's kind of annoyed. And he says, well, why did he go to California? He says, well, he says he went on vacation. There was no restrictions on his ability to travel. So he went out there, and he ran out of money. Last I knew, he was in Arizona somewhere, but he calls me periodically. And Judge Bruin really flustered, just says, yeah, fine, he went on vacation, but you're not explaining to me, during the midst of all this, why did he start to suddenly decide to travel? And Maddox made one of the best lines of the entire case. He looked at Judge Bruin without missing a beat, and he said, well, he's a man of the world, Judge. And by all accounts, Bruin himself kind of smiled when he said that, and the case was adjourned. Eventually, there was a warrant put out for him, but he never returned to Kingston. And so the case never went on trial. And you know, whether or not he did it and whether or not they could have convicted him, all of that is disclosed in the book. But that's one thing I'm holding back for the readers. You want to learn that when you got to buy the book. But
absolutely.
Because that's one of the few things that no one ever knew the answer to, and I found it. So
absolutely.
But it was Yeah. So when he, when I read that, when he said he's a man of the world, Judge, I said that's going in the book. No ifs, no ands, but that's a great line.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So the sentencing was shortly after, and what are the laws of New York in terms of what you could give a defendant a sentence to this second degree murder?
At that time, the maximum sentence was 25 to life, and that's what Judge Vogt sentenced him to.
And obviously, he did he have appeals? Did he exhaust those appeals? Did you write
he
about
filed
that?
Filed his appeals. He exhausted them. And then 29 years later, about a month before my book is to come out, he gets paroled. And he moved back into the area where I live. And I remember thinking to myself, this is like the ultimate example of Murphy's Law. I got a book coming out in about a month that's going to say he did it, and they cut him loose, and he lives in the area.
Wow.
And I'm not concerned about it. Like I said, I've concluded that he didn't intend to kill her. I mean, he was guilty by my conclusion. I don't think he intended to kill her. He did. By my reckoning, he served his time. He's out on parole. You know, I'm hoping that he's been reformed. We'll see. I'm not worried about it. If I was Todd Schlede, I'd be worried, because he's the one that really dropped the dime on him, so to speak. But
sure.
But it was just quite the thing. 1 month before the book, there it is.
You talk about too that Schlede and Dawson were good friends from the start. They were friends forever, weren't they?
They've been friends a long time, though. During his testimony, Schlede was asked, if they were friends, and he said, "No, we're associates." And he tried to downplay that they were friends, but the fact that Dawson confided in him what he had done, you know, it's not the type of thing you're going to go up to some stranger and say, "Hey, by the way, I just wanted to tell you I killed somebody." You know, so they obviously were friends. They had been known to hang out together quite a bit. But I highly doubt they would still consider each other friends anymore.
Sure. You write about what you think happened, and so you just mentioned that you think that it was an accident. So tell us what your conclusions were on what happened that night with Dawson and Annie Kitcart.
Well, as I had said, I think Annie was looking to find somebody to hang out with that evening and do something. And I believe they went into the alley together. And I keep saying alley, but the railway bed. I think they got into an argument. And, exactly what it was about, nobody knows. It could have been about alcohol. It could have been about doing something. I know some of the officers thought maybe it was a sexual overture by Dawson. She rejected him, whatever it was. Whatever the argument was, I think part of what Dawson said was true. I think he eventually said, "Get away from me," pushed her and so forth. And I think she got mad when he pushed her and probably started yelling at him. Todd Schlede had said he noted a slight bruise on Dawson's eye. So if that's credible, then perhaps maybe she smacked him. I think Dawson grabbed her in a chokehold, not trying to kill her, but to control her and calm her down. I think he hit the chokehold just correct on the carotid artery. And I think with the added adrenaline, the fact that he had done cocaine earlier in the day and was drinking vodka earlier in the day, that and all the adrenaline and his strength, I think he hit it just right. He fractured the horn of her larynx, and she went unconscious immediately. And I think he panicked, thought she was dead, and I think he decided to make it look like a psychopath did it. I think he is the one that cut the KKK in her legs. I mean, no one would ever suspect a black man of putting the KKK on somebody. You know, it's not something they would do. So he made it look like a crazy man did it to try to cover his tracks. And again, the sad thing really is that if he had not panicked and he just picked her up after she went unconscious and brought her to the hospital, he would have served some time in prison because he was on parole at the time for a burglary. He'd have gone back, but he wouldn't have spent 29 years in prison, and Annie would still be alive. But That's what I think happened.
You don't write about this in the book, but do you think that Dawson was well aware of the Tanya Brawley case, and that's why the KKK was carved into her specifically? Might sound like
I have
a dumb
no
question.
Doubt that he knew about Brawley. I mean, everybody was talking about it in those days. I mean, like I said, Poughkeepsie's only a little over 20 miles from here, so everybody and their mother was talking about it. It was the big news, you know. Whether or not that into his motivations, it might have. I don't know. It could have. It certainly could have.
Another interesting thing I want to ask before I let you go is that there was cocaine found in her nose, but not in her system.
Yeah, that's one of the big remaining mysteries. They found a small amount of cocaine residue in her nose when they did a, what they call a swab, and they were taking different samples and so forth, and they tested positive for cocaine, but it wasn't in her system. Had she snorted it, unless she was killed almost instantly afterwards, it should have appeared, and it didn't. Several possibilities. One is that she was sniffing it as she was choked and killed, which I don't think is likely, but it's possible. Second, it was put there post-mortem. Or third, it's a lab error. I don't know which it is. That's something that's never been resolved, but it is certainly a mystery of why there was cocaine residue on her nose but nothing in her system, because snorting, the reason people snort cocaine is it gets into your system right away.
Yeah. It was sad, too, that, that again, there's any depiction of a victim, their bad behavior or their past misdeeds. And it was sad to see that her father had made a statement that she was a victim of drugs.
Yeah, he did make that statement. The point that you're making actually goes to the title that I chose. It's why I call it Sidetracked. Some people think that it's because she was found by the side of the tracks, but that's not correct. The reason for the title is in several points. First, being murdered is the ultimate sidetrack. Her entire life was taken. Before that, I mentioned that she had been partying in the months before she died, so she had sidetracked herself, although she was getting herself back on track when this happened. Then, of course, you've got Kiernan, who comes in with all of his shenanigans that sidetracks a great deal the investigation. You got Sharpton coming in, and all of these things. And then the family, of course, they had to actually hold the funeral hours earlier than it was announced to keep the media from showing up and shoving microphones in their face and saying, how do you feel about this? Well, how do you think they feel? So all these different things were happening that sidetracked the investigation, sidetracked the family. And then I think the last part of the sidetrack is that as the years have gone on, prior to me writing this book, you never, ever, ever heard anything about her in the media after he was convicted. In fact, after he was convicted, they had one article where the police said, we're glad this matter is done. The next time the case or she appears in the paper is when he got paroled 29 years later. And even her memory got sidetracked. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, because I felt her story deserved to be told. She was a real nice lady and a nice person, and she deserved better than what happened to her, and she deserved to have her story told. And I just hope, as I say in the introduction, I hope I did justice to her memory.
Well, I'm going to say, Richard, you certainly did, and it's honoring her memory and talking about how the perpetrator of this gruesome crime was brought to justice, and it's a great story. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Sidetracked, the betrayal and murder of Anna Cathcart. I know this is a Wild Blue Press release, but do you do Facebook, there's a website for this, how people might look at other work? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. There is a Facebook page that I created for it. I'm a better writer than I am Facebook page creator, but it is there. It's the @ @sidetracked Cahill, CAHILL with a capital C. And that's where it's at, and you're welcome to come look at that. And there's a lot of information on the Wild Blue Press website. And if you go to YouTube and you put in Sidetracked in my name, you'll see at least you'll see two different videos. One that I and a friend of mine created with my voice, and then there's another one that my publisher created with another person's voice that's better than the one I created, but I think they're both good. But the one the publisher did was better because, well, that's what they do.
That's right, yeah. Well, thank you very much, Richard. It's been a pleasure. Sidetracked, The Betrayal and Murder of Anna Cathcart. Thank you very much for this interview. You have a great evening. Thank you.